Good afternoon. Welcome to the 422nd meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. To our members and guests who are here today, and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, to find out about upcoming forum programs, and to learn how to become a forum member, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Dr. Matthew Goodwin, who will be speaking on National Populism, the Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. Matthew J. Goodwin is a professor of politics at Rutherford College, University of Kent, a position he has held since 2015. He is also a senior visiting fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House. He is known for his work on British and European politics, populism, immigration, Euroscepticism, and Brexit. Dr. Goodwin started his academic career working for a self-funded research institute at the University of Manchester. Following that, he was a postdoctoral fellow at the Economic and Social Research Council, was a lecturer at the University of Nottingham, and he spent a year at a central UK government department. Dr. Goodwin is the author or co-author of 6 books. His latest book, National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy, with Roger Eatwell, was published by the Penguin Press in 2018. In 2015, his book, Revolt on the Right, co-authored with Robert Ford, was named UK Political Book of the Year. He is a recipient of numerous other prizes, both for his writing and for his work in disseminating social science research to a wide audience, which of course is what he's doing for us today. Dr. Goodwin writes regularly for international media, including the New York Times, Politico, and the Financial Times. Between 2011 and 2015, he sat on the UK government's working group on tackling prejudice. He has advised many governments, including the office of the UK Prime Minister, the European Parliament, and the US Department of State. Matt, a warm welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thanks, sir. Well, good afternoon. You've only had 422 meetings. Isn't that remarkable? I remember reading a book called Bowling Alone that told me that Americans were no longer engaging in civil society and creating these kinds of organizations. I think what you have with the forum and also the Camden Conference is incredibly special. It's my second visit to Camden in as many years. And when I received the invitation to fly over again, it was a no-brainer. This is a great place, a great organization. What other conference sends you back on the red eye to London with a bag of cookies? This doesn't happen in political science, I just want to say. Okay, let's get down to solving Brexit. And another reason, by the way, that I accepted this invitation was that it gave me 72 hours to escape British politics and have a break from the never-ending Brexit drama. So let's go back to where it all began. In the early hours of June the 24th, 2016, a seismic shock hit British politics as 52% of voters opted to leave the European Union, an organization they had been a member of since the mid-1970s. In the aftermath of that vote, David Cameron promptly resigned, becoming the third Conservative Prime Minister to be destroyed by the question of Europe. After Margaret Thatcher and John Major, David Cameron quickly vacated the scene and didn't even stick around to oversee the Conservative leadership election. He was gone. And amid the dust that was left, we looked at who voted for Brexit. 52% across the UK, but 54% of voters in England. One in three black and minority ethnic voters voted to leave the European Union. One in four university college graduates voted to leave. Large ethnically diverse cities like Birmingham voted to leave. Large numbers of middle class voters and affluent conservatives voted to leave. And very few people had even seen that vote coming. In fact, one survey of more than 300 journalists, academics and opinion pollsters prior to the referendum found that 93% predicted that Britain would vote to remain in the European Union. And what this moment really reflected was a fundamental disconnect between those who practice and talk and analyze politics and those who are voting at the grassroots. As soon as David Cameron had left, Theresa May won the Conservative leadership election. And Theresa May came in with a message that effectively explains her current predicament. She promised that Brexit would mean Brexit. She promised that Britain would leave the single market. She promised that Britain would leave the customs union. She promised that Britain would have an independent trade policy separate from the European Union. She promised that the unpopular freedom of movement policy, which dictates that anybody within an EU member state can travel and work freely in other EU member states, which had proven so unpopular among British voters, as we'd experienced record levels of immigration, that she would bring that to an end. She also said that she would tackle burning injustices in British society, in particular for the working classes. She sounded a lot like Harold Macmillan. She advocated a one nation brand of conservatism that seemed a world apart from the somewhat more uncaring, market focused brand of conservatism that came with Margaret Thatcher. And it paid off. For a few months, she was riding high in the opinion polls. Conservative Party had a lead of upwards of 20 percentage points. People started talking about the end of the Labour Party under the radical left-wing Bernie Sanders type of Jeremy Corbyn. And then everything fell apart. And how did it fall apart? It began by triggering Article 50, the process of leaving the European Union, with no plan. Once you trigger Article 50, you have 2 years in which you have to negotiate the withdrawal agreement, your exit from the European Union. There was no plan beyond simply beginning that process. Theresa May then called an early general election in June 2017, and during the campaign for that election, decided to irritate core Conservative voters by saying that they would have to sell their homes to pay for their own social care when they get older, which had nothing to do with Brexit. She then, in the aftermath of that election, and finding her majority considerably reduced and her power completely dependent upon the Democratic Unionist Party, had to make do with cobbling together a Brexit deal that effectively satisfied nobody. It had some partial access to the single market. It didn't give Britain a comprehensive, independent trade policy. She promised that freedom of movement would still come to an end, but it wasn't clear how she would guarantee that, given that most of the politicians in Westminster seemed very hesitant about her new deal. She then brought that deal to Parliament and failed to command sufficient support for it. She then brought it again and failed to win sufficient support. She then promised that she would resign from office if MPs could provide support for her deal, and they still said no. Which brings us to where we are today, which is a parliament effectively in paralysis, a Conservative Party that is in open civil war, and an electorate that has never been quite so disillusioned at any other point in Britain's post-war political period. British politics, I would argue, is currently broken, and nobody seems to have an answer as to how to fix it. So let's begin by asking ourselves, firstly, what's interesting about this Brexit moment? The first thing that's interesting about Britain's Brexit moment is that this is the first time that the European Union has officially contracted. This is the first time that a major power has voluntarily chosen to leave the European Union. And by doing so, it's underlined a broader challenge that's facing the EU, which is the rise of populist, anti-European Union, anti-immigration sentiment. Ever since the vote for Brexit, public support for staying in the European Union has increased in every other EU member state outside of Britain. That's not surprising. Brexit has been a car crash. But the drivers of Brexit remain just as visible in every other EU member state. One in two voters across the EU say, my voice does not count in the European Union. If you ask voters today what are the top two issues facing the EU, they don't say the economy and public services. They say immigration and terrorism. And as you'll see next month at the European Parliament elections, a lot of parties like the populist parties that we had in Britain ahead of the Brexit vote, the UK Independence Party and Nigel Farage, are set to have their strongest European Parliament election since the creation of the European Union. Their current share of seats in the European Parliament is forecast to increase from about 25% to around 38%. Populism is just as visible across the EU as it is in Britain. The second thing that's interesting about Brexit is that this was the first time in British political history when a majority of people outside of Parliament asked for something that a majority of people inside Parliament didn't want to give. 52% of voters opted to leave the European Union. 75% of voters, by the way, without a college degree, opted to leave the European Union. But around 75% of members of Parliament campaigned to remain within the European Union. The vote for Brexit was always destined to deliver a political and constitutional crisis. It was always going to bring us to this point. It was always going to expose a glaring divide between those outside of Parliament and those within Parliament. And I've been rereading a book that was published in 1963 by Gabriel Armand and Sidney Verber, two social scientists, called The Civic Culture. And in the early 1960s, Gabriel Armand and Sidney Verber argued that Britain was the classic civic culture. It wasn't like the Italians and the Germans. It was deferential to authority, it trusted institutions, it was respectful, and it focused on compromise and bargaining. It was the very opposite of what a populist democracy should look like. Fast forward to where we are today, and I would argue that what's interesting about Brexit is that it's turned that civic culture on its head. According to the opinion polls yesterday, 80% of British voters say the two main parties no longer offer them an appealing choice at elections. The support for populist parties over the last 2 months has doubled. We're now looking, potentially, at the return of populism, not the resolution of populism. The third reason why I think Brexit is interesting is because it's overturned an unwritten law in British politics. And that was called the Westminster model. And the unwritten law was that Britain has a strong unitary state with a dominant executive, and that the legislature will always play second fiddle to the executive. What we've seen over the last 3 years, nearly 3 years now, is that the executive has gradually seen its power and influence eroded as Parliament has reasserted control over the Brexit process. I don't think we've ever had a prime minister, certainly not in recent political history, that has been as diminished in office and as weak as Prime Minister May. She is destined to become the fourth Conservative Prime Minister to be destroyed by the question of Europe. And what we've seen, particularly over the last 3 to 4 months, is Parliament effectively taking control of the Brexit process and demanding that Brexit is softened, that Britain remains within the customs union, which is the Labour Party position, that Britain remains within much of the single market, which is shared not only by Labour, but also the Scottish Nationalists, the Greens, the Liberals, and a new breakaway pro-EU party. And that issue of freedom of movement, which played such an important role in bringing us here to begin with, is effectively taken off the agenda and not really discussed. If we see a Brexit deal, and it's a big if, it's going to be a lot softer than the vision of Brexit that was outlined by Theresa May when she first became leader of the Conservative Party. There's no appetite in Parliament for a no-deal Brexit. There's no appetite in Parliament for Mrs. May's vision of Brexit. There is only now, I would argue, growing support for a very soft vision of Brexit, what I would call a Mr. Whippy ice cream vision of Brexit, growing support for a second referendum on the very question of Remain versus Leave, and minority support for revoking Article 50 and cancelling the process altogether. I think a fourth reason why Brexit's interesting is because it's cut directly across our traditional political loyalties. We're now in a situation where 70% of Conservative voters say they want to leave the European Union, and preferably without a deal. But we're also in a position where 65% of Labour voters say they want to remain within the European Union, and preferably within the single market and the customs union. Brexit has cut across our traditional loyalties like a hot knife through butter. And it is an impossible tension now for the parties to satisfy. Both have significant numbers of voters within their electorates that hold a fundamentally different view of Brexit than their party leaders. The Labour Party woke up on the same morning as David Cameron to discover that 60% of Labour-held constituencies had voted to leave the European Union. But the Conservative Party is now grappling with the fact that it's losing London. It's losing the university towns. It's losing middle-class professionals. And what's happened to the Conservative Party over the past 2.5 years under Mrs. May's leadership is that the Conservative Party electorate, and this is the crucial point to understanding the current paralysis, the Conservative Party electorate has become progressively more pro-Brexit since the referendum. One byproduct of Mrs. May calling that election and demanding that Brexit must mean Brexit and no deal is better than a bad deal, another one of her mottos that has died an early death, they've hoovered up pro-Brexit, blue-collar workers, voters without college degrees, and former populist voters that used to vote for Nigel Farage. As a consequence, the internal logic of the Conservative Party is now one that is overwhelmingly in favour of a meaningful, clean break from the European Union. So there is no way that Mrs. May can currently satisfy that electorate unless she leaves the European Union with a much more radical deal than that which she is about to bring to the table following negotiations with the opposition Labour Party. We've come to a point where Conservatives are absolutely furious with what the direction of their party. Because on the one hand, they were told 6 months ago that Jeremy Corbyn is an international Marxist who poses a threat to Britain's democracy, and who poses a threat to Britain's allies, in particular, Israel. At the same time, Mrs. May has now invited Jeremy Corbyn in to talks in number 10 Downing Street to broker a compromise on the question of Brexit. And Conservatives, I think, are rightly asking, why are you conferring a much greater sense of legitimacy onto this opposition leader, who only a few months ago you were arguing poses a fundamental threat to British democracy. So the rumours flying around British politics over recent days are that we're seeing mass desertion from grassroots conservative associations, that we're seeing conservative members tearing up their party cards, and we're seeing a big movement back towards a populist party which was founded on Saturday called the Brexit Party, founded by Nigel Farage. A curious irony, a sad irony, is that now Britain is going to have to hold fresh elections to the European Parliament next month because we have no deal that will secure our exit from the European Union. So we're now going to hold elections to an institution that we thought we were leaving. Now think about how that's going to go down among ordinary voters. European Parliament elections are characterised already by low turnout, and they are primary vehicles for expressing anti-establishment sentiment. According to the latest polls, the Conservative Party are on 15% of the vote, which would be their worst result since the early 1800s, at a nationwide election, I should add. The Brexit Party is already polling 12%, which combined with its rival remaining UK Independence Party, together they're on about 25% of the vote. So we're now going to go all the way back to where we started, which is a populist party winning a nationwide election, demanding a vision of Brexit that Westminster does not want to give, with both of our mainstream party electorates having been really broken by this question, and Britain being more polarised than at any other time that I can remember, but I think really more polarised than at any other time in our recent national history. And I think what's really interesting about this particular moment as well is that nobody seems to have an answer for how we can fix it. What worries me about Britain today is that we are now seeing a lot of research and evidence in the social sciences which suggests that our identities as Remainers or Leavers are becoming just as important to us as our identities as Labour voters, Conservative voters, or Liberal Democrat voters. That we have a new political identity in British politics, and it's a lot more divisive. I was laughing last night with some of your colleagues about data in the US that showed that 40% of Americans now say they would feel uncomfortable if their son or daughter married somebody from the other political tribe. Which to me, I found quite amusing when I looked at it. And then a couple of weeks ago, we had a survey in British politics, and they asked Leavers and Remainers, would you feel comfortable or uncomfortable if your son or daughter brought home somebody from the other Brexit tribe? And 11% of Leavers said they'd feel uncomfortable if their kid brought home a Remainer. 37% of Remainers said they'd feel uncomfortable if their kid brought home a Leaver. So we are seeing the polarization that you are seeing, but I would suggest we're just a few years behind you. And what worries me is that nobody is interested in consensus anymore and compromise. Because of Mrs. May's actions and because of the evolution of the Conservative Party, the next leader of the Conservative Party either has to be a Leaver or has to be somebody who strikes a very strong Leave message. The Conservative grassroots, if you ask them who would you like to replace Theresa May, the two most popular options are Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. Those are two very strongly pro-Brexit individuals. Meanwhile, the internal logic of the Labour Party is that the next leader has to be somebody in the Jeremy Corbyn tradition because 500,000 new members have joined the Labour Party and they kind of like what Jeremy Corbyn say. So the direction of our two main parties, I think, is only going to move in a more polarised, towards a more polarised destination. While the public opinion context in Britain certainly points in that direction, If you ask conservative voters what they want now, they say no deal. Just get this thing done. Just leave. We'll take the economic shock. We'll take the GDP hit. But again, if you ask those Labour voters as of yesterday, what do you want to do? Now they're beginning to entertain the idea of maybe not leaving at all. And in between all of this, we have these new political parties that are trying to coax harmony and compromise back in. And I think what's interesting too about Britain is the question of what did we get wrong about all of this? What did we underestimate? And I was reading a book by one of your politicians. The book's called What Happened. And I got to the end and I realized she still doesn't know what happened. And there's a very similar dynamic playing out in British politics, which is nobody seems to know where this thing's come from. And what frustrates me about British politics today is we've just had nearly 3 years since the referendum and nobody yet has come up with a comprehensive plan that will deal with the grievances that led to the Brexit vote to begin with. Utterly remarkable situation to be in. One of the fundamental things that went wrong is that everybody underestimated support for leaving the European Union and the extent to which that was anchored in a long tradition of Euroscepticism. I would take a very contrarian view in that I would argue that support for leaving the EU was actually always the favorite, that leave was always the favorite. Why would I argue that? I would argue that because ever since Britain joined the European community, it was very clear that we didn't share the effective attachment to that community that the Germans and the Italians and the French did. If you want to read a book, I would recommend the original book on the 1975 referendum by David Butler. And David Butler, who is the godfather of election analysts in British politics, made a very interesting observation in the mid-1970s when he said that yes, Britain had voted to join the European community, mainly for economic reasons, not political. We were the sick man of Europe at that time. But he also made the observation that support for joining was wide, but it was never deep. That we never had the effective loyalty to Europe that our continental neighbors did. Why was that? We weren't invested in the idea of a European identity. The Germans and the French were, because they needed to navigate feelings of national shame, national humiliation, and they needed to carve a new vision for Europe. And they needed to invest themselves fully into that. Britain didn't need that. Britain's history, its national course, was fundamentally different. We'd emerged from the Second World War victorious. We sometimes mistakenly believed that we were still an international major power, as the Suez Crisis forcefully underlined. But we also never really shared this interest in political and social integration. Economics, fine. But political and social integration, no thanks. And that came out at various moments. It came out with Margaret Thatcher asking for the rebate. It came out in her very famous Bruges speech in 1988 that she didn't just roll back the Soviet Union in order to impose what she saw as an authoritarian political structure at the heart of Europe. It came out in John Major's request for key opt-outs from various policy decisions that were being taken. It came out in terms of our opt-out from the euro single currency, our opt-out from Schengen, and really Europeanism only found its true expression under Tony Blair, who decided that he would actually allow freedom of movement into Britain before many other European democracies, and who did seriously entertain the idea of joining the euro before his Chancellor Gordon Brown said that might not be such a good idea. But pro-EU identity has never really been visible in Britain. In fact, if you look at all the survey data, never more than 14% of Brits have said, I feel European. What matters, if you want to understand Brexit, is the distinction between Englishness and Britishness. If you said to me, I'm English, I would say, you're a Brexit voter. If you said to me, I'm British, I would say to you, you voted Remain. Because that's typically how the numbers fell down. Britishness was always a far more outward, inclusive, international conception of who we are. Englishness was always a far more insular, a more narrow identity. But as Linda Colley argued in her seminal book, Britons, in 1992, both of those identities were still ultimately shaped by Britain's experience with Europe and by defining itself against continental Europe, against Rome, against the French, against the Germans, against. And in combination with a jingoistic, nationalistic press, Colley, even as early as 92, made the point that Euroscepticism was likely to return in British politics with a real kick. And boy, was she right. She also argued that Englishness would return with a really big kick. And that's where we're about to go. If you want to know what the big debate in British politics is going to be over the next 5 years, I would argue that it is going to be very much about Englishness and people demanding that we give greater resource, greater attention, greater energy to an English parliament, to sending resources away from London into provincial England, and that will increasingly become a significant political force on our landscape. So Euroscepticism over the long term was always, I think, the favourite. And the interesting question to ask is not why did 52% vote for Brexit, but why did only 52% vote for Brexit? Which brings us into this idea of a second referendum. I'm a pragmatic political commentator. I accept that people voted for Brexit, and my personal view is we should probably work with it, and that we should use this moment to address the grievances that got us here. And those grievances are perfectly clear. We've had 15 academic studies of the Brexit vote since the referendum, and they've all told a remarkably consistent message, which is that there were two main reasons people voted to leave. One was to lower immigration and to reform freedom of movement, and the second was to get a greater sense of judicial independence or national sovereignty back over national institutions relative to the European Union. The whole idea that leavers didn't really know what they wanted is not true. They knew exactly what they wanted. And now we have a choice as to whether we work with those grievances and carve out a new settlement that will address them, or whether we now aggressively make the case for a second referendum and try and overturn that original result in 2016. If you ask me to predict what happens next, Theresa May is currently locked down in negotiations with the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn and will be pushed, inevitably, towards a soft Brexit deal that will not satisfy her aggressively pro-Brexit voters. The Conservative Party will potentially split. I looked at the numbers this morning for this talk, and without sounding too sensationalist, we are seeing things that we have never seen before. The Conservative Party, since Brexit Day, which didn't happen on March the 29th, the Conservative Party has averaged 32% in the opinion polls. Okay, that is about 10 points below what they got at the last election. And that is putting Jeremy Corbyn in power if we have a general election. Many of my friends in the city say there is a two-punch combination coming for Britain. It starts with a bad Brexit deal that satisfies nobody, and it's followed by a radical left-wing government that alienates business, introduces wealth taxes, nationalizes much of our public utilities, and adopts a completely different foreign policy perspective with regards to issues in the Middle East and elsewhere. Meanwhile, support for those two populist parties is back to 12%, which ensures that if there is an election anytime soon, the Conservative Party has no hope of holding on to power. And then the interesting question becomes, how big could that disruption become? And what's interesting to me is that the leader of that new Brexit party has a very clear model in his mind, which is the Canadian Reform Party. And if anybody knows Canadian politics, you'll remember the early 1990s when the progressive Liberal Conservative Party was replaced by the Reform Party. It was one of the most devastating election results in the history of Conservative Party politics in the Western world. Nigel Farage now wants to do that to the British Conservative Party, in that he wants to tear off the Eurosceptic MPs, the Eurosceptic voters. He wants to win the European Parliament elections next month, and then he wants to go head-to-head with the British Conservative Party, winning over as many of those Leave voters as he can, as well as Brexit voters in Labour's more industrial heartlands. Brexit has resolved nothing in terms of the original divides that brought us here to begin with. If anything, Brexit has put populism on steroids, which makes me incredibly sceptical about where we are and where we're going. And be careful what you wish for, because if we have that second referendum, and here's where I see more parallels with your politics, Remainers haven't reflected at all on what went wrong in 2016. If anything, they've made a succession of terrible strategic decisions since the vote. There's been no attempt to rekindle support with leavers. There's been no attempt to establish a different conversation. Where Remainers went wrong in 2016 is that they talked only about the economy, and they talked absolutely not at all about borders, security, and migration. And that allowed leavers in through the back door, who offered a very simple but devastatingly effective slogan, take back control. They've already decided on what the slogan will be at a second referendum, and it's also got three words. Tell them again. Remain wants to meet that by talking about the economic costs of leaving the EU, the economic costs of no deal. And in my view, at least, have failed to appreciate a fundamental fact that is running through all of our politics, which is that voters do not only evaluate the health of their nations through GDP. A large number of voters are profoundly anxious about what you might loosely call cultural security. Stronger borders slow the pace of change, try and get more control over globalization. And some might argue that's an unrealistic position to take, but that is the view that is rumbling through British politics, where voters are telling me in focus groups and surveys that they feel just as strongly concerned about those issues as they did in 2016. The best case scenario for Theresa May, I think, is that she quietly exits the national stage, presides over a Conservative leadership election, which paves the way for a general election that at least allows the Conservative Party to present a fresh face and a new set of policy ideas. One of my friends remarked before I left that the only person to benefit from Mrs. May's premiership is Lord North, because now he won't go down in history as the worst prime minister that we've ever had. And I think on Patriots Day, you can enjoy that comparison. Mrs. May won't be remembered for much. Mayism never existed in the way that Thatcherism or Blairism did. She will be remembered perhaps favorably in that she was willing to take on the job when very few people were. But this will be ultimately framed by future historians as a textbook case in how not to negotiate and how not to lead a Conservative Party. So when we look at where we're headed, and my final remarks before opening up for questions will be, we've come a long way from Armand and Verba's civic culture. There's absolutely no guarantee that we're going to get back there anytime soon. And we've failed comprehensively and sadly to resolve the divides and tensions within our society that led to the vote for Brexit to begin with. And what you're going to see next month, unfortunately, not just in Britain, but across the European Union, will be another reminder that very few people have got a serious answer to the question of what is driving people to vote for national populists across much of the Western world. You'll be happy to know there is an answer. It's $17. And it's on the table outside. And if we run out of books, there's some flyers. You can get them on Amazon. And hit me up on Twitter and let me know what you think. But I'm incredibly depressed, as you can tell. But I'm looking forward to my red-eye flight and at least having some cookies to get me through back to Blighty. So thank you for your time, and we can go in for some questions.
Thank you very much, Matt. Very interesting, but not very uplifting, I think. Good way to put it. Let me ask the first question while we're collecting the... Let's wait till this gets up. While we're waiting to collect questions, let me ask one of my own. Given how interconnected the world is today, where can all these populist movements actually lead us? I mean, what's going to happen if we go back to nation states that are isolated? And is Britain a good, you know, test case here in Brexit?
So I think the short answer to that question is populism is still a very live experiment that we're all living through. So if you look at what's going to happen next month at the European Parliament elections, we are going to see a significant attempt by Matteo Salvini in Italy to link up with similar national populist movements in other EU member states. And they've already outlined what their program is going to be. They want to restore what they call loosely national sovereignty. They want more powers devolved from the European Union back to nation states. They secondly want greater control in particular over migration and the handling of the refugee crisis. And thirdly, they have specific issues over the role of Islam within Europe, which will increasingly become a very divisive issue. Whether they can actually implement a policy program at the European level remains the big unknown. Even on a good day, they may win 40% of seats in the European Parliament, but that would be quite exceptional. And even then, they're going to remain strongly divided within the European Parliament because they can't all agree to join this new alliance. So I think what we may find is something of a continuation of this populist story in Europe, which is a lot of public expressive support for these parties, not yet necessarily translating into concrete new political and policy action. At the national level, though, it's a different story. We're already seeing the consequences of a populist government in Italy, whether it's in relation to the opposition to vaccination for children, which is now interestingly being reversed after an outbreak of measles, but also, secondly, their very hardline approach to refugees and the closing of ports and not allowing boats to land on the Italian shores. So we are seeing in different European democracies the emergence of a new, more conservative policy profile that I think will increasingly bear down on what you might call liberal Europe. The Macron vision over the next 5 years will increasingly be squeezed, not just by national populists, but also by radical left parties that argue that what this is effectively is a continuation of more neoliberal free market globalization, which they feel very strongly opposed to. So I think the jury's out.
Thank you very much. As you can see, we've got a huge number of questions here. Let me ask, here's one, there's two or three here, very similar. You've talked a lot about England and not much about Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales. They, I believe, tended to vote against Brexit. Well, how do they play into this, or are they being ignored by London?
They're not being ignored. I think, if anything, the nightmare scenario for Britain is not only that we've successfully brought populism back from the dead, but that we've also somehow managed to now threaten the Union like no other time in recent political history. And What's interesting is if you look at Scotland, which voted overwhelmingly 60% to remain, as did Northern Ireland, Wales, don't forget, voted to leave. Wales has much higher levels of economic deprivation and, in the end, endorsed Brexit. But if you look at what's going to happen over the next 5 years, the first thing to say is there is currently not majority support in Scotland for a second referendum. So of the latest polling, around 45% of Scots say they'd like to have a second independence referendum. And if you, even if you then ask Scots, well, what would you do if such a referendum were to take place? Nicola Sturgeon is still unable to command majority support for independence, and she knows this. So what's interesting to me is that Brexit actually hasn't galvanised the case for Scottish independence, which is contrary to what we expected at the time. And I think the reason for that is that the economic experience of Scotland since the first referendum in 2014 has undermined many of the arguments that the Scottish nationalists made that their economy would be able to thrive and prosper outside of the UK. Northern Ireland, of course, is a far trickier issue, and it may well be that what we end up seeing over the next 2 months is the emergence of a Brexit deal that effectively includes a customs union and single market membership, which takes the Northern Ireland backstop issue off the agenda. Because conceivably, we won't need to resolve the backstop issue if, like the Republic of Ireland, we are in the single market and we're in the customs union as well. Alternatively, if we end up with a very pro-Brexit Conservative leader who now wants to double down on the idea of no deal, then yeah, we've got a major problem. And nobody seems to currently have the answer to that. The idea of frictionless trade and border security that doesn't involve setting up new infrastructure on the border, these have all been undermined and presented as not being credible or feasible by the various authorities. So the Northern Ireland issue and the backstop issue could easily disappear, but it could easily escalate, depending on what the nature of that new Brexit deal is going to be.
Thank you. Here's one on UKIP and why they did so poorly in the 2017 election, and yet now you're talking again about making a comeback.
Well, that in itself is a fascinating dynamic. What we saw was Theresa May promising to deliver paradise to Brexit voters at the 2017 election. So UKIP voters ran over very quickly to Theresa May and said, I'm here for the real deal, I'm here for the Brexit that you're promising. And then since 2017, large numbers of those voters have concluded that actually the Conservative Party is not going to deliver the Brexit means Brexit model that Theresa May had promised. And so on Saturday, Nigel Farage launches the Brexit Party once again, as he did between 2010 and 2015, capitalizing on those Conservative divisions and pulling over very hard pro-Brexit voters that would otherwise support the Conservative Party. And Theresa May has a really big problem now, because the vast majority of her voters are, as I've said, decidedly pro-Brexit. So my prediction would be that Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party will gradually replace UKIP as the primary populist party. They will either win or come second in the European Parliament elections next month. That will pile more pressure on the Conservative Party. And then they have a strategic dilemma themselves, which is, okay, you can win a proportional representation election, which is the European election, but how do you win under majoritarian first-past-the-post, which is a very different electoral system? And once we have a general election, it's going to be quite hard for Nigel Farage to get over that hurdle unless what he's banking on, unless he gets a wave of defections from Conservative MPs. If Nigel Farage starts to win over the pro-Brexit ERG group, which has about 30 MPs, if he starts to win over serious Conservative funders and donors, and by the way, the rumour in Westminster is the Conservative Party's running out of money because the donors won't give them any money as long as Mrs. May is in charge. They've got about 1.5 million in the bank. The Brexit Party has about 4 million. So, you know, you're seeing some interesting organisational dynamics playing out as well. But how the Brexit Party can get over that first-past-the-post majoritarian system remains the big unknown. And if they can do it, who knows? All bets are off.
Just a follow-up to that, and is a question here. Will Nigel Farage's past ties to Donald Trump and Julian Assange help or hurt his prospects in creating a successful party?
It's an interesting one. Most of the people that are voting for Farage in British politics, I know he's now a friend of Fox News, and he's been visible in the sort of the CPAC conference, and you know he has very strong links through some of his young advisors to the Donald Trump camp. Most British voters are not tuning in to that. Now, you may read about it in The Guardian, but in general terms, that is not going to hurt Farage among the pro-Brexit voters that he's drawing on. Pro-Brexit voters, unsurprisingly, are quite open to the idea of Donald Trump. Now, Julian Assange, less of an issue. I mean, the Assange case is certainly topical, and people are watching it, but this is not a make-or-break moment for the Brexit Party and Farage. People are not zooming into that issue to the extent that you might think. As we know with populists, they are very good at wearing Teflon and avoiding sticky situations. And I think those two are sticky situations. My worry for British politics and American politics, in a way, is actually what happens if the Conservative Party does suffer a significant split as we head into a very difficult set of US elections next year. And we all have to look back on this moment and realize that actually nobody had an answer to it at all, and everything's just happening all over again. And that's the worst case scenario, I think, for a lot of people, because we've not really reflected seriously enough on why we're here. We've looked at a lot of comfort blankets that have perhaps sat quite comfortably with our pre-existing beliefs, but we've not really thought through how we're going to reconnect with these groups of voters that are vacating traditional, established mainstream politics.
Sorry to jump around a little bit, but as I discover the questions, I dig them out. Here's one. Why did Theresa May have such a hard line on Brexit right after the election, as you commented, when she had previously opposed it? I mean, what was the rationale?
The rationale for Mrs. May was that there are two different interpretations. One is that Mrs. May said she voted Remain. Whether she did is another thing altogether. Mrs. May was in the Home Office, equivalent of Homeland Security, and she took a very tough line on particularly immigration. For her, reducing immigration into Britain is a national priority. But she also judged, I think at that moment, correctly, that the internal dynamics of her Conservative Party were incredibly pro-Brexit. And so she had to take that tough line. Now, what then really has turned into her undoing is that while doing that, she didn't really come up with a long-term plan for how she was actually going to translate that moment into a Brexit model that could command considerable support. And that was really exacerbated by the 2017 general election, in which she violated a fundamental unwritten rule, which is if you're a Conservative Party, try not to irritate Conservative voters. And so by telling a lot of over 65s that they're going to have to sell their homes in order to pay for social care, when you don't really need to say that during an election that's principally defined by Brexit, might go down in the history books as one of the worst campaign promises to make. So as a consequence, she was greatly weakened. And of course, many people in her party argue that one of her big strategic failings was not adequately preparing for no deal, triggering Article 50 too early, and then being unable to come to the negotiation table 1 or 2 years after the 2016 referendum and be able to say, okay, we're ready to go with no deal, let's negotiate. That's the Conservative mindset. So the Conservatives would argue her big strategic failure was triggering Article 50 with no plan and then never really being sincere about keeping no deal as a credible bargaining chip in her pocket. And here we are today, which is probably one of the lowest moments in British politics. I think it's worse than Suez, actually. I think this is a really low moment in the post-war evolution of British politics.
You mentioned no-deal Brexit. There's a question here that, to follow up a little bit on what you were saying there. How bad would a no-Brexit deal be 1 year out? Isn't it, it's just the short-term problem?
It is a major problem. I mean, if you look at the estimates for no-deal, these are not like the forecasts that came out before the 2016 referendum. I mean, those forecasts, which were released by the Treasury, suggested that if Britain voted for Brexit, 500,000 people would lose their jobs, that we would have an immediate recession, and that Britain's growth would be considerably constrained. What we've seen in reality are some of the highest employment figures that we've had since the 1970s. Wage increases are now outstripping inflation. This is not a success story, by the way. Our economy, like most economies in Europe, remains weak and forecast to slow down. But those original pre-referendum dire predictions didn't come to fruition, which has led many in British politics to say, well, maybe the forecasts around no deal won't come to fruition either. The problem with that is we are dealing with a fundamentally different scenario where EU law has been paramount in many cases for aviation, for supply side networks, for the customs, for goods, for services. And we are not even in a position where we would have what you might call a no-deal light scenario ready, where we have a succession of agreements in place that could manage, for example, the transfer of pharmaceuticals or aviation rights and travel. It's unclear what would happen to British citizens in other EU member states. So I think there would be a considerable supply-side shock. The question is whether voters would put up for that, would put up with that, if they felt that the long-term gain and the long-term trade-off was worth it. Leavers say they would. When you survey leavers, they say, I always thought we'd have a short-term hit, but fine, I'll deal with that short-term hit and then I'll take the long-term benefits. But of course, a strategist would argue that by simply presiding over that kind of moment, the Conservative Party would lose its reputation, well, its lingering reputation for competence, and would preside over something like Black Wednesday and the ERM crisis in the early 1990s, which killed the Conservative Party and laid the foundation for Tony Blair and 13 years of Labour dominance. So the fear in the Conservative Party is very much that this a no deal is simply impossible if they want to retain any sense of a reputation as being economically competent. So these are the trade-offs that are going on right now, you know, within Westminster.
So, again, let me follow up, because maybe it's just me who's not clear, but what does a clean break, is there such a thing as a clean break that's not a no-deal exit, and what would that look like? What are the elements?
So a clean break Brexit, in my mind, is effectively a no-deal Brexit, in that the EU is not going to agree, now knowing the weak position of our government, is not going to agree to what you might call a meaningful Brexit that allows Britain to remain outside of the single market, outside of the customs union, with a bespoke free trade deal, a Canada plus plus type deal that also gives us concessions on freedom of movement. I think some would argue that the Brits were always a little bit naive in thinking that they could extract considerable concessions from the EU with regards to their four freedoms. So, you know, people in Brussels would certainly argue, if they were speaking to you today, that the EU would never negotiate on freedom of movement, that it is one of the four key founding principles of the European Union, and that it will never give a parallel EU associate state major concessions on that issue, which is why many have felt that no deal is the only plausible outcome, because you're simply never going to get into this position where you can negotiate a bespoke, ambitious, original agreement with the European Union. And so to me, a clean Brexit is effectively a no-deal Brexit, which means leaving the single market, the customs union, and ending freedom of movement, reverting to WTO, and then starting from there while dealing with the considerable damage along the way. There's no political appetite. I mean, there's no major political appetite within the current House of Commons for that option. The House of Commons has effectively ruled out no deal and put legislation in place to make that largely impossible. I think the current House of Commons would actually revoke Article 50 before they would allow no deal. They just view it as an absolute catastrophe for the British economy, and they've effectively ruled it out. Could it change if we have a new Conservative leader with a general election and a big Conservative majority? Potentially. If you have Boris Johnson saying, let's go to the country, I'm the new Conservative leader, it's time to deliver Brexit, you get mass turnout among leavers, you get big turnout among Eurosceptics, maybe. But I mean, the odds of that, I would suggest, are around 10-15%. I mean, this is not a likely outcome in my mind. So we'll be left with a lot of people who feel that the Brexit deal we eventually get is not actually going to satisfy anybody. Remainers will say, what was the point? We're kind of in the European Union, but we have less influence and we're still paying into the budget. And we've still got freedom of movement. And leavers will say, what is this? This is not Brexit. We're still in the single market. We're still in the customs union. We're still paying into the budget. What exactly have we got out of this? Which is why I'm slightly boring in that I thought Mrs. May's deal was actually the best compromise for everybody. Because Mrs. May's deal, though widely unpopular, that was the point. It was a 52-48 deal. It got you out of key elements of the single market, but it kept you in the single market for services and goods. It also got you partly out of the customs union, which at least gave Britain the potential for an independent or semi-independent trade policy. And it kept free movement, which proved so unpopular among voters, off the table. So it allowed Britain to negotiate its new immigration policy. But of course, it couldn't command sufficient support in the House. And so that one's gone too.
Thank you. We've got several questions here, and let me read a couple of them on outside influences on Brexit and this whole process. To what extent do you think the Russians have a heavy hand in disrupting the UK and the EU? And how much populism do you feel is driven by the social media and external influences?
I can only go by the studies that I've read since the referendum. We've had about four major studies that have looked at the intervention of Russia-backed social media bots during the referendum. Those studies generally conclude that there was some activity, but that the effects appear to have been very minimal. Many of those bots were active after voting had stopped. Some of them were telling people to vote Remain. Some of them were talking about completely different issues that weren't aligned to the referendum. There's not really, in my mind, much in the way of credible, serious evidence that can suggest the Brexit vote was delivered by conspiratorial, dark, shadowy figures or organizations. That's not to say that we don't have an issue with electoral integrity. We have good reason to investigate the referendum in the same way that you're investigating the integrity of your institutions here in the US. But I personally find the argument, for the reasons that I've laid out, that this was due to some foreign influence rather than just an expression of a long-held tradition of Euroscepticism, not very convincing. The role of social media more generally is something we have to take incredibly seriously. We do need to remember that we had populists in Europe before we had Facebook and Twitter. Not many people like to make that point these days, but we've had very successful populist movements in France and Germany and so on, Italy, long before we had social media. But what you're seeing in the evidence now is, I think it's quite convincing, that what social media is doing is it's exacerbating the underlying divides that we have between liberals and conservatives, between graduates, non-graduates, between those that are anxious over the identity issues and those who are more driven by those economic concerns. A nice study in the US exposed Republicans on Twitter to Democrat bots that basically gave Republicans a lot of Democrat information and stories. And at the same time, it exposed Democrats to a lot of Republican Twitter bots. So they were getting the Republican view of the world. And what they found at the end of this study is that rather than promote understanding and compromise as everybody gets to see the world from another person's perspective, they actually found that they just polarized even more. And that's a nice example of confirmation bias, which is what we're seeing in Brexit. If you give Remainers a study that suggests Brexit is going to be economically damaging, as we've done with some political psychologists at Kent, they say, yes, absolutely, this study's brilliant, I trust it, it's amazing. If you give the same study to Leavers, they say, I don't buy this, I don't think it's reliable, I don't think it's trustworthy. So we are seeing a real problem now in just how people interpret the same pieces of information. And that's the concern. And even when that information is coming from independent bodies, you know, we've seen a remarkable collapse of trust in the UK in experts and non-political institutions, which is incredibly worrying. Again, that slogan, tell them again. It's not tell Westminster again. It's just tell them. It's a very broad definition. That classic populist signal that it's the people versus these elites in a very broad sense.
Well, we have a tremendous number of questions left, but we're running out of time. I just wanted to ask one final question, which is, do you believe the identity conversion toward Leavers versus Remainers is reversible, is irreversible? And is this going to sort itself out? Or are we in for a long period of...
I don't think so. I think if we met in 5 years or 10 years' time and look back at this moment, I don't personally get the feeling at the moment that what we're seeing is a short-term blip. It feels far more to me that what we're seeing with these new political identities is the politicization of a new sense of tribalism. That now, for the first time in the history of British politics, we have a pro-EU identity that is being actively cultivated by Remain-focused parties, which we've never had before. But we're also seeing the active cultivation of a more nationalist, anti-Westminster, anti-EU identity that we've always had, but I think now is going to become far more entrenched. And it's not entirely clear to me what will break that down. Perhaps we need a major crisis of some proportion to try and bring people back together. I personally make the argument that Britain needs to return to national service, as I think actually forcing people to mix and interact with others who have very different views and values is something that we are losing. Because what you're seeing and what we're seeing are these divides that are playing out between the cities and rural areas, the cities and small towns. We've got lots of convincing evidence from the US to the UK to France that these different value tribes are not even mixing anymore. They're self-selecting into areas and communities that reflect their own point of view, that reflect their own ideological priors. And we are now seeing exactly the same thing in Britain, which is deeply unsettling. So my gamble would be that where we are now, which is amid a partial realignment of British politics, my $10 would actually go on this turning into a full-blown realignment. And that could have a lot of unpredictable consequences and effects on our party politics, on our relationship with Europe, and on who we are as a country.
Well, I thank you very, very much.